continuing to talk about how men use language as opposed to how women use it. Women rely, I'm reading now, number four, women rely on nonverbal communication more than do men. The old joke, he says, this is a young couple, honey, what's wrong? And she says, well, if you don't know, I'm certainly not going to tell you. Yeah. What's wrong? Nothing. Now, women are better at nonverbal communication. Women read other people. Women read nonverbal communication. Men don't very well. And women assume, listen to me, women assume that men do. What have I said over and over? Women relate to their husbands as if they were other women. Women often assume that everybody reads, picks up on this, and women interpret. Women, often, wives, will interpret the inability, let me say this accurately. Women interpret the non-reading of these non-verbal signs as insensitivity. Now, from the man's point of view, he's just confused. You see, if a woman is hurting, she's upset about something, her woman friend knows it instantly. She can pick it up over the phone. She can pick it up in the tone of voice. She'll say, something's wrong. I can tell. Understand? Women read their husbands very well. The women understand their husbands much better than the husbands understand their wives. Now, did I say that before? No. If a man says, I understand, if a man says, I understand my wife perfectly, he's an idiot. If a woman says, I understand my husband perfectly, she probably does. Women understand their husbands better than husbands understand their wives, anyway, to be more fair. I'm not saying men don't understand their wives, and they don't understand to the depth that women do. And so women, if she's hurting, her friend picked up on it, and her husband didn't. What does that mean? Well, my friend loves me, my husband doesn't care. She often reads it that way. And I'm not making this up. This really happens. Even couples who are going together, you know, here's what happens. He'll say something that made her mad. And here's what a woman does, well, especially a young woman. Engaged couples do this a lot. He's offended her, and he doesn't know it, but she knows it. And so what this young wife or this fiance will say, well, here's what goes on in her mind. She doesn't use these words, but here's the process. She'll say, he really made me mad. I'm just going to see if he loves me enough to read me. I'm going to see how long it takes him to figure out what he did. And women don't do this. I'm going to see how long it takes them to figure out what they did. You see, what he's in a race of barriers, and he set up these barriers, and she's going to say, I'm going to see if he loves me enough to get over them. And if he doesn't, he's in trouble. The problem is, he's in a game, and he's losing, and he doesn't even know he's in a game. I mean, he doesn't know they're there. He keeps muffing it, and he goes on ignorantly and blithely, you know. And he keeps getting deeper and deeper and deeper. And she gets madder and madder and madder because it takes him longer and longer and longer to read her, to pick her up, right? To pick her up, to pick up on this. And pretty soon he's in deep dog dookie, as my boys would say. Right? And he doesn't even know, has a foggiest notion what's going on. Finally, when it gets so bad, here's where it comes in, Joe. When it gets so bad that nobody could miss it, I mean, the family cat can pick up on it, then he'll say, is something wrong with you? And that really sets her off. And nothing, no, you don't know, I'm not going to tell you. And boy, you know, she's really huffy. And here, and she's serious, and he's confused. And this happens. This happens. And the reason is that women are simply better at reading, that they're better at nonverbal communication, and they can read nonverbal communication, whether it's intended or not. You got that? You see, she feels very bad because, listen, young husband, when you're upset, she reads you instantly. Doesn't she? I mean, when something's bothering you, she knows it when you're still out in the driveway. she'll say, something's wrong, I can tell it, whatever. And you thought you were hiding it pretty well. You understand? And so when something's wrong with her and you don't read it, she misinterprets it. She says, well, he just doesn't care. You understand? She misinterprets it. She interprets it as lack of sensitivity, which is a misinterpretation. And really hurts communication. Now, do you recognize this? Yes. Yeah, and you wanted, you're saying, keep digging, yeah. Often when a woman tells, learn this, now keep in mind, when she says, I don't want to talk about it, remember, that's a woman that said that. Women do not always say what they mean. If a man says, I don't want to talk about it, he doesn't want to talk about it. The woman says, I don't want to talk about it, she wants to talk about it. But she wants you to care enough to make her talk about it. Right? She wants you to care enough to say, no, tell me. And she may say it two or three times. Listen, you know, I don't want to talk about it. No, honey, I want to find out. She's saying, go for it. You know, in her heart, in her mind, she's saying, leave me alone. With her mouth, I mean. But she doesn't mean that at all, very often. You understand? She wants you to, she's saying, do you love me enough to figure it out? Do you love me enough to make me tell you? Now, she doesn't sit down and plan to be that way. She's a woman. My wife would be very upset, and I pick right up on it after about 4 hours, you know, when I didn't get any sleep. You know? But then, after she'll send out these signals. And this sounds humorous when you talk about it, but it's not funny at the time. It really causes trouble in a marriage. Lack of communication. Now, isn't it true? You got a good girl, a woman friend, you're talking about it, but they just pick up on it. They're the third word. They see your face. They hear the tone of your voice. They'll say, I can tell something. What is it? Now the rule is, here's how you get as near the middle as you can, as often as you can. Never forget that. As near the middle as you can, as often as you can. That's why you do it. Women, the rule for you, I put this in the syllabus for you ladies. The rule is, never assume you've got to tell it. You've got to say it. Got that? The rule is, you've got to tell him. Men aren't very bright. Well, men aren't, but in that way, they don't pick up on that. It's not fair, listen, it's not fair to condemn him if you haven't told him. Now, after you tell him and he ignores you, then go for it. I mean, you can give him everything he deserves. But it's not fair to a man. It's not fair to a man for him to be in hot water and he doesn't know why. A man doesn't really mind being in hot water if he feels he belongs there. You know, he can take that. He can live with that. But to be in hot water and listen, it is extremely frustrating to a man. It makes him want to hit somebody. Really, it's very frustrating for a man. I don't mean not that he would. It's very frustrating for a man to, you're mad at him, but you won't tell him why. You're playing this game. It's like, the fellow doesn't mind losing the game if he knew he was in the game, but to lose one because he didn't know he was in it. You know, you struck out. You say, honey, a man doesn't mind striking out, but if he strikes out because he never knew he was at bat, it's extremely hard on a man. And he can get very, very angry, say some things that shouldn't be said. On the other hand, go ahead, yes.
I have a
problem
with the problem, but I can't say that when I know I'm wrong, when you tell me I'm wrong,
men are arrogant. We love to be right. A man would rather be right than rich. doesn't seem that way now, does it? Well, I thought, wait a minute, the real girl there, tell him. He's stupid, tell him. He's not going to pay, he's not going to get it until it gets really bad. Tell him. The rule for the men is, men, tune in. Tune in. There's a game that a woman cannot win. If you keep your mouth shut and you don't get there, not only are you not there, he's humiliated. He's humiliated because he knows he's going to fool himself. So not only did you not get there, but you arrived late. You know, in other words, here's your problem. If you keep your mouth shut, you arrive late with a fool who knows he's a fool. If you say something, you're in trouble because for the very reason you said. And I don't have an answer to you, except a man needs to know that men are arrogant. We are arrogant. You should bring that up. That was such a problem in our early marriage. We did so much traveling. If anybody was like that, I would. I mean, I drive for 45 minutes and hunt and sniff the air and everything else, rather than admit I didn't know where I was. And finally, at about the fifth or sixth go-around, I mean, serious go-around, I realized that this was, two things. My wife has a very good sense that she can find anything. She's a very good navigator, spooky. And so, rather than have that happen again, I just gave her the job of being navigator. Kind of relaxed. Now, I would chart out the basic trip, you know, but she loves to read the map, and if she says turn, I turn. And if we get lost, I can jump on her. But I'm serious. I actually turned it over to her and said, you're the navigator, and she's better at it than I am. Because what I do when I drive, see, when she drives, when we're on a trip together, she thinks about where we're going. She loves to go. I use driving time to think about everything but where I'm going and driving. I've even missed the exit up here twice going home. I mean, you guys professional help to miss the exit off the turnpike. Because I was thinking, you know, I was writing sermons or thinking something through. And so what happens is that I don't keep that sense of where I'm going. And it worked out great. It's a great compromise because I can forget about it then. And I just say, honey, where do we go? And she'll say, turn in. Or I just turn, happy as a clam, you know. And so that leaves me free to not concentrate and solve a lot of problems. You know, we used to have some terrible fights that way. And I was that way, you know. A man's like that, you know. I don't know where we're going, but we're making great time. Like you were next to me. That might be the solution. Whatever. What? Yeah. I'm for whatever works within reason. I'll tell you, my wife is a good driver. She drives faster than I do. So if we want to make time on a trip, I always let her drive. She drives faster than I do, and she's a very good driver, but a man is arrogant. And it's very hard for a man to sit in the driver's seat and let his wife drive. No matter how good, and my wife's an excellent driver. And so we've had station wagons or vans for all the years raising our kids. And so I can either drive, I can drive, but I cannot sit in the front seat while she drives. And I'm nervous, and I make her nervous, and we get it up in a fight. And so what I do is, I tell her how, what I do is, I make it very simple. I tell her how fast the limit is to drive, and I always tell her 5 miles under what I really think I want her to drive, because she's going to drive 5 miles over it accidentally, of course. And I go to the as far back in the van as I can get, and I lay down so I can't see. And it's great. I get a rest. I take a book. I get a nap, and we get there earlier than we would have had I been driving, and we ride friends. You learn. I'm very serious in this.
When we were growing up, Mom had, she knew we were going to dead and get lost and we never admit it. So Mom invented the game that kids would try to figure out where they were going. And so the kid who found the sign first or whatever got to ride up front. And that way it kind of softened the blow so Dad would realize that he was stupid and Mom wasn't. But he would never let Mom drive going on trips. And then when the kid got to the driving age, he would let us drive.
Men are arrogant. We really are. Men have delicate egos. Arrogance creates a very fragile ego.
I have a question. Even if he's wrong, he's not retarded. Even if I give him an alternative, he wants to do it his way first. So we have this, it's almost like a game, we do it for you, and then I'll say, and I'll be looking at it like, I don't think this is right, but could you, because I'm going to do it, he really doesn't, but he thinks he's right, and he's going to do it his way. So it's like a game, he'll go, okay, you have any suggestions, and I'll tell him. But he'll go ahead and do it his way, but if it's wrong, he'll go, well, I guess you were right. And it's a lot easier for us, because we don't get mad, because I would get really mad, especially if I know I know what I'm doing.
If you get mad at the arrogance of your husband makes you mad, you're going to spend a lot of time mad. You'll be a full-time occupation, just about.
How far do you push it? I mean, anything with the arrogance, there comes a time when you have to say something. How far do you push it without hurting them and threatening and hurting their ego?
I don't know. You have to just judge the individual situation and the person.
You learn how to do it in ways that they're not going to get upset about it. You learn how to play it, manipulate it, and say, instead of coming out and saying you don't know where you're going, it's what word I'm saying?
Yeah, I knew that.
We're early. I wanted to drive her up the block. Yeah.
Well, of course I. I planned on going to Seattle through Mexico City. Whenever I go to Seattle, I always go through Mexico City. It's the jalapenos, peppers I go to. The ultimate solution is for men to recognize their arrogance. Let me just say this to you. We've laughed a lot in here, but that really, one of the things I teach about family life is that life will give you all the misery you need for nothing. You've got to manufacture your own joy. And there's no sense in manufacturing your own misery when you get all that for nothing. And the second thing is, you can handle some real tough situations with a light touch. You can get over some pretty sticky things and learn a lot if you don't take yourself too seriously. But men take themselves too seriously. We really do. And actually, the odd part is, the more masculine the man is, the harder it is for him to come off his high and mighty and say, you realize I'm making a fool of myself, at this moment. So you can talk about it ahead of time, but when the time comes, we are arrogant. Now, let me come back to the mainstream here. What's the rule? Ladies, tell him. Tell him. He cannot pick up on it. Second, men, tune in. My wife taught me that phrase, tune in. We're going to say this later, come back to this when we talk about the parent-child relationship. But you must understand that women understand their children better than men do. And I can't count the times my wife has said to me, you need to tune in to Adam. He's been upset about something for 3 days. Well, I played basketball with Adam. I'd kidded around with him. I didn't know it. You need to listen to him. You need to tune in.
Understand? So men need to do their best to tune in. And often we just don't listen or watch or notice. And so we need to notice our wives and tune in. And what was I going to say? Well, we need to develop a genuine sensitivity to how to read our wives better and listen. Any questions on that? That's a very important thing to learn. Okay, let's move on now. Women, we're still talking about communication. We've talked about how they use words and the role of conversation and nonverbal communication. Women are more open than men. The no trespassing zone I'm reading now is smaller for most women than it is for most men. By that I mean, every one of us has, and has a right to have, an area, what I call the no trespassing zone, an area of our life where we maintain absolute individuality, where nobody goes but us and God. Now, we've got a right to that. And everybody that is in that no trespassing zones are things that we have never told anybody, never shall tell anybody, and we not even told God, although He knows it. You got that? We all have that. We have a right to that. What I'm saying is that this no trespassing zone is larger for most men than it is for most women. That is, most women will tell more things, by that I mean more personal, intimate things about themselves to another woman than a man will ever tell to another man. Got that? Just on the average, you get two women who are good friends, they know much more about each other than two men who are good friends. Men stake out, they put their no trespassing zones, no trespassing signs farther out. A lot of women don't know this. Now, men are culturally conditioned away from openness, psychologically gagged, finding it more difficult to speak directly about personal or emotional subjects. You got that? Men find it harder to speak directly about emotional or personal subjects than most women do. Now, looking at our syllabus, women tell more about themselves, but, listen, young wife, the wife has no right to tell a third party something about her husband that he would not tell about himself. Now, that's a good rule. A wife has no right to tell a third party anything about her husband that he would not tell that person about himself. If you want to see damage done to trust, I mean real, if you want to see trust and confidence really wounded in a marriage, you let a man finally, in a weak moment, or what he considers to be a weak moment, tell something intimate about himself to his wife, and then he hears it coming back at the next party, because the wife has told a friend and she's told her husband and it comes back to him. You talk about one furious male. You've got one furious male. And what he will say to himself and what he might say to his wife is, it's going to be a cold day before I tell you anything else. And it's going to be a long time getting over it. And I've seen this happen. And women, and often the wife, and if the man confronts his wife with it, there's a big fight because she doesn't understand. She says, what's wrong with that? That's what she'll say. There's nothing wrong with that. Wait, what's the big deal? Nobody cares about that. You're making something out of nothing. You understand? And it may be nothing. Maybe she's right. But the point is, if he would not tell that person, you cannot tell that person. And, you understand that? That's a very simple thing. And that's something that women don't pick up on. Understand? Women often, dealing with their husbands as if they were other women, they will assume that his no trespassing zone equals hers. And when she says, what's the big deal? She really means, what's the big deal? And men need to understand that. She really doesn't see anything wrong with it. Now, The modern myth, I'm reading now, that equates unlimited openness with sensitivity is a dangerous one. This was really big in the 60s and 70s. The modern man, he's open. He spills his guts. He tells it all. Men are naturally more private. If a man is manipulated into telling something he really wishes to keep to himself, he often later resents it bitterly. You have to, often women will manipulate or sort of force a man into telling things he really did not want to tell, or before he was ready to say it, to tell it, and later, when he thinks back on it, the next morning, he resents it bitterly. He felt like he's been used. Understand? Now, women don't care that much. They care, but they don't care that much. They don't care as much as a man does. Did you know this, ladies? And did you know this, gentlemen? Now, this is why women can get closer to people. You realize that most women can get closer to people than most men. Most women have more friends than most men do. The circle of friends, a man's circle of real friends tends to be small. There are a lot of men with only one friend, one really good friend, or two. Women tend to have three or four or more. Okay. So, we must permit each other our no trespassing zone. And listen, the no trespassing zone means no trespassing. That it means only God walks on that ground, not your wife. And women often misinterpret this as, they interpret it as an unwillingness to be open, when really it's just maleness very often. Now the other side of this is men. It's a two-sided coin. I give both here in our syllabus. Many things ought to be kept secret, kept between God and ourselves. It does not require that we spill our guts. A lot of marriages have been damaged by things being told that there was no need to tell them. Listen, if there's something that can really damage your marriage, and you've already dealt with it between you and God, just let it remain between you and God. There is not always. Sometimes there is. I'm giving you one side of the coin now. There are things better just for, you know, put under the under the forgiveness of God and forget them. Go on and move on. And everybody has these things, just about, you know, almost everybody. Move on. You understand? You don't have to tell everything. Life isn't like that, and it's not sensitivity to tell everything. It's stupidity to tell everything in many cases. The other side of the coin is husbands must be willing to communicate in depth. Otherwise, the relationship will always be superficial and unfulfilling. I sound like I'm contradicting myself, but I'm not. I'm saying, let me illustrate it this way, to use my metaphor. The no trespassing zone for most men is larger than it is for their wives, first of all. For most men, the no trespassing zone is too large. For some women, the no trespassing zone is too small. You understand? I think sometimes, now this is a man speaking, so you're getting a man's point of view. So let me word it this way. I think sometimes women tell too much, but that's a man speaking. I know that often men tell too little. Men are too closed as a class. Now, some men aren't at all. But some men, you know, they're like talking to a statue. And I think men would be better. For instance, listen to me, fellas, it is one thing to talk about things that, which I've already mentioned, which don't need to be talked about. Forget it. Go on. But a woman, fellas, does not understand when a man, for instance, won't tell her how he feels. A woman takes it as a mark of confidence and closeness if her man will sit down with her and say, "Boy, I'm really hurting these days. I'm really worried. You know, may not seem like a big thing, but this is really getting to me." If he'll say that rather than just think about it and set his jaw like a piece of iron. You understand? Isn't that right, lady? He'll come down and say, "Look, I want to share this with you. I want you to know that I'm really upset. I need to talk with somebody." And men need to do that more as a class. Well, what do you think about that? You agree or disagree? Or am I being fair, you think, at that?
What are you talking about, Mr. Speaker?
Well,
I get some ideas what it might be.
Well,
it wasn't that bad. If you have a past life, is it like?
Yes.
That's what it's become Christians later on in life.
Yes.
And you've done things that,
yes.
You don't have to.
Yeah, there's no. Some things maybe yes, but not every. Not, in other words, what I'm saying is, see, that's a good example. Here's a guy who wasn't, you know, had a bad, you know, a worldly past, becomes a Christian, gets married. Just because you did it, you don't have to tell it. If you've dealt with it with Christ, in Christ. Now, I'm not saying that automatically don't tell anything. I'm simply saying you don't. I'm saying there's no rule that says everything that was done has to be told. That is just not realistic. It's just not smart. Why make your wife carry around or your husband carry around a lot of garbage that there's no, that, you know, there's no good served by it, there's nothing to be gained by it? It's, you haven't lied to them, you understand? We're not talking about lying. We're just talking about why make them carry it around? There's no need for it.
Would that make the guy overall feel guilty? I mean, have to say it all over again, have to face up to it again?
Yeah, I think it would. It's just putting a negative in the marriage. It doesn't have to be there if there's no purpose. Now, if there's a purpose for doing it, fine. But if there's no purpose, do we believe in forgiveness or not? See what I'm saying? I think, often, if somebody, a woman often pushes it, she feels like, if he doesn't tell me everything, then we're not close. And that's a mistake. A lot of women have pushed their husbands, and a lot of husbands have even, because they're jealous, have pushed their wives into telling things that really messed up their marriage, and nothing could be done about it. It didn't serve any purpose. It didn't fix anything. It just...
And uses it against her.
Yeah. It just it can poison a relationship. When there was absolutely no reason to do it. It's one advantage of being a Christian. We can start again. Now, I'm not saying it covers everything. You understand what I'm saying? I'm just simply saying it. But a lot of stuff just doesn't have to be told. You don't have to say everything. There's a time to speak and a time to be quiet. Women tend to speak too much sometimes about some sort of subjects. My wife has admitted that, told me that. Men often don't speak enough. Well, you think about that. And I hope I don't make you... let me say this to you, ladies. I really hope you know that I hold the female gender in the highest regard. And I hope nothing... I don't know how it sounds because it's coming from a man, but I hope that nothing... I intend nothing that I say to be a put-down of ladies, and I hope you don't, you know... When I say I think women often talk about things, women admit this. They often, you know, and they don't understand. I'm putting down men just as much because we often clam up and won't talk. And you understand? If a man's not going to tell his wife how he feels, if he's not going to open up his life to his wife, he needn't be surprised if she doesn't feel close to him. I've seen more than one case where a woman would be married to a handsome man, a pillar in the community, a good provider, and one day he comes home and finds a note on the kitchen table. She says, "Honey, goodbye, I'll never see you again," and she runs off with a bum, an ugly, overweight bum. Why? Because this guy would talk with her. He'd talk and listen. I'm serious. He said, "Why?" You know, and if you ask it, I asked a woman this one time. She did that. I talked to a woman who actually did this. And she said, "Because my husband didn't care anything about me. He wouldn't talk with me. He wouldn't tell me anything about himself. He just, you know, he provided well. He provided a nice home, but he just, you know." And this guy would sit down and hop up his feet and just communicate and talk. And the husband didn't understand it at all. I mean, he just couldn't figure it out at all. Well, any comments from anybody on this? Questions? Well, let's finish up then this part. Aids to communication. We list this now. Time together in prayer. Now, Tim Tedrick asked me about this, and but one of the greatest aids to communication is time together in prayer. Let me say this: prayer. You know, sex is spiritual, primarily, physically, physical second. And that there is no, that the I'm going to say later when I come back to sex. Well, I'll just wait and say it later. Let me deal with it later. Let me just say, time together in prayer. I'm going to talk about family devotions later on under raising children. I'm going to talk about sex under sex. So let me just say, that's an aid to communication at this point. Secondly, mutual unlimited grace and mercy. Great aid to communication. That is, listen uncritically. Fellows, men are especially bad at this. When a woman is talking to her husband, and maybe she has, Kim, you know, she's been wrong. She's done something she felt silly doing. I learned this the hard way. A woman, when she's talking to her husband, wants an audience and a friend. She does not want a judge. But men, being arrogant, we often feel that we're sitting on up there with our robe on, and we feel it's our job to pass judgment. For instance, this can be something very simple. If she comes to you, fellas, and says, "You won't," and I've fallen into this trap, I still do. She'll say, "You won't believe the silly thing I did today. I feel so silly." And men do this as often as women do, you know. But we don't admit it. If a man does something, if a man really pulls a boner, I mean, he's done something, a bonehead mistake. He'll keep his mouth shut and hope nobody notices. Right? A woman, she feels so bad, she's going to tell her husband. And she'll say, "Honey, I did this. Yeah, I can't believe I did. I was so silly today." And then she tells you. Men, you do not say, "Well, that was silly." Or, "How could you say something like that?" Or, "You really didn't do that, did you?" I promise you, you'll wish you hadn't if you say that. You see, what she is asking for is a sympathetic friend. She did not want to go into court. She did not want to, and she was not looking for somebody to agree with her. She was looking for somebody to say, "Well, honey, that's no sillier than a lot of things all of us have done. Don't worry about it. You don't normally act like that, you know. That's not your normal." You understand? You don't lie about it. That's a huge difference. Because I used to do that. She said, "Well, you sure were." And very logically, he said, "It's a man, the arrogant man, you know. I would never do anything like that. I can't believe you did that." Right? And, oh, didn't help her. You know, what you understand? What you say is, and if a man does it, if a man, ladies, ever gets around to admitting his bonehead mistakes, you know, 3 or 4 times in 30 years, when he ever admits it, you absolutely do not agree with him, because he is arrogant, and he does not want to be reminded. What you say in either case is, "Well, it wasn't that big a deal. Don't worry about it." Or, you know, I know how. Say something like that, which is absolutely, "I know how you feel. I do, you know. I wish I hadn't." She said, "Why did I say that?" I said, "Yeah, I know how you feel, because I regularly say stuff I kick myself for." You understand? You want somebody to care that you're embarrassed. You don't want somebody to reinforce your embarrassment. Right? You want somebody to say, "It's okay."
Sometimes the guy can cover up the fact they made a mistake. Oh, yeah. Like, you know, depressed. They get down about it. They're not going to come out and say, "Okay, I can be innocent." Michael got his break. He let his roommate fix his break. And he did it wrong, and so he ended up paying $90 more than what he would have paid to have the one happen three times after they had already been done once, and he had to pay extra money for it. But that, if he called me and he was down and he was saying, "I just can't spend any money," but inside, now that you said this, I think the whole idea was he made a mistake and he was upset about the mistake.
his depression, that's a sign of arrogance. You see, what we're saying is, I can't believe that somebody as smart as I am did something so silly. That's what, without those words, that's how we feel about it. Feel the same way. He just doesn't show it.
Does he feel happy about it?
Oh yeah. But here's the a lot of women. They feel, oh, I feel happy. I'm thrilled. I want to tell somebody. I want to show him. I want to be giddy. I want to do something irrational. I want to like skip class. I want to. And when a man feels great, he says to himself, boy, I'm real proud of that girl. I'm really happy. This is great, isn't it? Yeah, okay. What's next? Oh, serious. He just thinks it over and he's tickled. He doesn't make a career out of it.
Does he get excited for until he's sure that he's got you, and after he's sure he's got you, then it's kind of like...
That's up to you.
Yeah, that's right.
What do you mean?
You let him back off of that one, he'll back on.
That's right.
But that's you where continue to grow together, and it gets more.
It's kind of hard when you tomorrow.
Well, this is not happening.
It's okay when I go there, okay? It's weird.
I'm crazy about, I'm 10 times as crazy about my wife as I was the day I married her. And several times more silly. And,
you just not show it as often as that it's
well, I used to never show it at all. I've had to learn all this the hard way. Not very, well, I say not at all, not as much. My wife wouldn't agree with that. She always gives me credit for being a better husband than I am.
Well,
was. But you have to learn to, you have to work at it. Before I left this morning, I grabbed my wife and gave her a hug, big long one. I mean the real thing. I'm not talking mess. I'm talking about something that's worth your while. And I explained to her again. I explained to her again about how I got such dumb luck as to a guy like me to get a woman like her for a wife. Just sweetens the whole day. And nice when I, but it's up to her, Steve, but she works at it. It's up to her. It's up to you.
Whatever works.
Let me say this to you. I may not be addressing what you're asking. The giddiness settles down. The crush. But what it settles down to is something that doesn't have the highs and lows quite as much. But it's deeper. Better. It's more substance to it. It gets better. I only encourage couples. You see, the first year of marriage is the worst. You don't even know what you're doing. And often, you see, a lot of couples think that the first year should be the best, and it goes downhill from there. Oh no, doesn't work that way at all. First year is the worst. Then you start learning how to be, for most couples. And in second, third, and fourth year, you begin to learn how to really care for each other and how to. You work at it, and it gets better the longer you go. I feel so sorry for you guys. You young, healthy, just soon to be married or just married. I'm serious. I feel very sorry for you. It's going to take, you know why? Yeah, it's going to take you so long to really get all the joy. And I'm not putting you down. It's life. You have to live. You can't rush life. But it's so much. You all think you see every young couple who's really in love. They think they invented love, and I did. I was that way. You know, my wife and I thought we'd invented romance. You know, nobody really loved each other till we met. But the best is yet to come.
Like if a guy and a girl, they get in an argument or something. Like the girl has her emotional feelings. You know, fall down on the guy, love this person, so it's okay. guys get like, what am I doing? You know, or, I mean, because I don't know, I can't understand how guys feel when they're 11. Do they just think, like, what am I doing? Why, you know, I don't understand.
Do they become irrational? And the answer is yes.
But we won't admit it.
We don't admit it. But for instance, I remember when I knew, when I really knew that I was going to marry Linda, was when our relationship, we were not engaged yet, of course, but something had happened. I was working late, living a schedule that I didn't have time to see her. Well, what happens is, if you don't have time to see each other, you expect too much of those moments when you do have, and you try to cram too much in them, and you both get frustrated, and you end up in a fight. You know, you haven't seen each other, you haven't had an evening out for 3 weeks. We have, or two of the more important ones. Were there any questions from anybody that came up in your reflections on what we talked about? Well, we're talking about the fact that men and women are different, and we got into this very important area of communications, and we were saying that men and women use language differently. Language has a different value to women. It serves a different function than it does with men. Women use words in a different way. And we talked about aids to communication. Well, we come now. Are there any questions or, I'm serious, comments about that? Do you find it helpful or instructive? What happens if couples have been married for a while, it helps them understand some of the things that have been going on in their own marriage, some frustrations. Well, and let me just say this in trying to apply these things, and as you know, I'm trying to be as practical as I know how to be in this class. I recommend the direct approach. I like the direct approach to anything. And ladies, if your husband starts dealing with you as if you're another man in the area of communication, say, look, honey, remember, I'm a woman. Just tell him, remind him. And men do this. I say this to my wife every so often, honey, I'm a man. You got to use words. I don't hear what you're thinking. You got to tell me. And so she does. She says, well, I'm gonna. My wife finds it very much harder to talk to me than she does to talk to her sister, because it takes more effort. She has to think more about it. Her sister understands better than I do, for the reasons that I gave. Well, I put this in. I don't know where to put this in our syllabus, but it needs to be in here. The 10 least wanted men. The FBI has this list of 10 most wanted. Well, I have the list of the 10 least wanted men. Now, you can read least wanted woman for the female versions. We're going to look at the male side of this, because and every one of them has a female side, but I don't get into that. Perhaps the next syllabus I will. But I deal with the men, because men, as I taught you in the first part, men bear the primary responsibility in the home. The home doesn't work, it's our fault. That is, we are responsible to make it work. And the first is the loner. He's marooned on the island of his indifference. He is emotionally self-sufficient, creates the illusion of strength simply by being inaccessible. He's the fellow who loves being by himself, doesn't need anybody else, will tell you he doesn't need anybody else. He's the fellow who will say to his wife, I got along, the song came out of the 50s, got along without you before I met you, going to get along without you now. And therefore, anything that he does for his wife is the grace, because he does not need her, and he does not need to be with her. He is capable of only distant or transitory relationships. One of the concerns that experts, and I'm not an expert in this field, as you know, but one of the concerns that the experts have in this about child care is that when child care, daycare, outside the home care, begins too early, that bonding does not take place. When the children are 2 and 3 and 4 years old and they spend the day in the daycare, they suffer intensely. These are the hours when they should be bonding with their parents, mother in particular. And so what happens is the child compensates for this by isolating himself emotionally or herself. That is, they learn subconsciously and act subconsciously on the principle that if I don't make attachments, I won't get hurt. If I don't care too much about mommy, I will not suffer too much when she leaves me alone again in the morning. And so children who are raised in daycare from their early age tend to be loners. They tend to find it hard in later life, that we're beginning to discover, to form these bonds, these lasting relationships, these substantive relationships. Do you recognize that? And many men are incapable of it. One of the things, let me say this to you, one of the reasons I urge that you raise your children right is that if you don't raise your children right, you're probably going to end up raising your grandchildren. Because if you raise children who cannot be emotionally involved in it, who are loners, then they don't make good marriage partners. Well, the second least wanted man is the strong, silent man. He's seen one Gary Cooper movie too many. This is an American phenomenon arising from the Puritans. It's nurtured by the frontier as an intellectual. It was nurtured by the frontier as an intellectual phenomenon, emphasizing self-reliance, social reserve, and emotional terseness. He is very close to the loner, and there may be some overlap there. But he's the fella who never says much. He plays it straight, but he never weeps and never laughs, or seldom weeps or seldom laughs. He is strong, but he's silent. He is detached. The third is the charmer. Third least one in man. He makes a show of artificial emotions. He masters the form of openness without the substance. When he's single, he's the lady killer, the Don Juan. He knows how to, he uses his imagination, he really knows how to court a woman. He compresses them, he sweeps them off their feet. Usually after marriage, he finds it very hard to be faithful. He's basically narcissistic, that is, he's in love with himself. When he dates his girlfriend, he's really impressing himself. He's watching himself perform. He's manipulative, and he uses charm to conceal his insecurities. All surface froth and no substance. Nothing beneath the surface. Now, I've met charmers, guys who just really know how to sweep the girls off their feet. And then later on, they wonder why. It doesn't make a very good marriage partner. The next is the sadist. He's the cruel person. He's emotionally shallow, self-absorbed. He wins a woman and then demeans her. He's insecure, and he compensates for his insecurity by reducing others in his own mind. The sadist systematically dismantles the woman he marries. Now, this is a very real thing, students. I have seen this. I can give you names of sadists. They marry a woman, and then, to make up for their own low self-image or lack of self-esteem or security, they systematically reduce her. They convince her that she is worth nothing. They always put her down. For instance, nothing that she does is ever quite right. Compliments are few and far between. I've seen men convince their wives that they were utterly dependent upon him, that they have no individual or autonomous value, and he's the poor fella who cannot relate to anybody that he does not feel like he's superior to. And since he's superior to so few people, he takes advantage of marriage and demeans his wife. He's usually a bully. I recently had dealings with a man who was a bully. And as with most bullies, he's a coward. And he bullies his family. I recently had a run-in with a fellow. He bullies his big fellow, bullies his family, and he made a mistake of trying to bully the wrong people. But the point is, this fella will create a very unhappy home. The wimp is next on the list of the 10 least wanted. He's usually characterized by absence of will and lack of success. He never knows what he really wants to do, and when he does do it, he doesn't do it very well. He is extravagantly gentle, sensitive, and often artistic. Not always. There is no necessary connection between being artistic and being a wimp, but many wimps are art. Often there's that link. Many, many exceptions. He's sensitive, gets his feelings hurt easily. Self-doubts are a way of life for the wimp. He goes through life saying, am I really worth anything? Is this really good? Do you really love me? Do you really want me? Oh, please want me. Please love me. He expects others to carry him through life, especially the woman he marries. And God help the woman who's married to a wimp. Because when things get tough, he will handle the responsibility over to her and say to her, in effect, you make it work, I can't. I've got a headache. The wimp whimpers his way through life. He's a whimpering, simpering, a poor excuse for a man. And he is really the female in the relationship, and his wife becomes the male. And wimps come in all shapes and sizes, by the way. Wimps can be big and strong. Wimps can be weightlifters. Wimps can be the opposite. Understand? There's no connection. Listen to me, students. There's no connection between the physical, or very little connection, between the physical and the spiritual in this matter. That is, some of the wimpiest men I've ever known were big, strong fellas, physically. And some of the strongest men I've ever met didn't look like they could do much in a fight, but they were stronger in horseradish. Understand? So there's not this connection. Wimps tend to wear neckties that are like fish.
Yeah.
Just kidding. I couldn't. I knew you were trying to get a comment out of me, so I thought I'd. And women despise being married to wimps. Wimps are initially attractive because they are so sensitive, and some women are attracted to sensitive men. But you can only take, after a while, that which is so attractive in the beginning is enough to gag a maggot later on. Pretty soon, it's more than you can take if you get nauseous. Then comes the bleeding heart. He avoids present commitment and responsibility by making a career out of past broken relationships. Here's the fellow who's had a bad experience with women, and he makes a career out of it. That is, he never can quite be happy with the mate, with the woman he's got, because a woman in his history treated him so badly, or at least he thinks she did. He's the bleeding heart. He feels sorry for himself. He's very much at home with the wimp. Then there's the weirdo. Weirdos, wackos, space cadets, and neurotics often appeal to the opposite sex because they are unpredictable and represent a challenge. And this is especially, by the way, Christian girls are especially susceptible to weirdos, because weirdos look very much like missionary projects. Well, you look at a weirdo and say, boy, he needs help. And I'm a Christian, I'm in the business of giving help, I'll marry the fella. Won't that be a help to him? Now, often his weirdness passes for individuality. The weirdo keeps his wife off balance. She cannot live her own life. A lovable oddball that is incapable of substance in a relationship. I was in a revival up north, sometime in the recent past, and they had a married a couple in that church. She was a delightful person, had the patience of Job, because she was married to a weirdo. And everybody knew he's a weirdo. And here's what he did at my first sermon in the revival up there. He cornered me, and to everybody else's embarrassment, he instructed me how I should have preached that sermon and how what he expected the rest of the week. And I knew him. I'd met him before, and I said to him, "Do you really think that I'm going to pay attention to you?" here's a guy who's so weird. It's hard to insult him. Now let me tell you, a weirdo may be cute when he's single. His unpredictability may come across as individuality. He's his own person. He does whatever he feels like doing. He wears whatever he wants to wear. He says whatever he wants to say. And that's all very, you know, cute and winsome. But don't ever marry the fellow. Listen to me. What's going on over here?
You know a weirdo. Who is
it? I don't want any names. Listen to me. While a weirdo may be cute and winsome and entertaining, do not marry the fellow. He stops being entertaining very quickly. And listen to me. A weirdo is just a weirdo. That's all he'll ever be. And so stay away from him. And a lot of weirdos are... Then there comes one of the ten least ones, the bore. He talks incessantly about himself and about the petty and trivial. He is seldom interested in others or in talking about things that matter. The bore, feelings, relationships, life, meaning, deep things, he does not talk about. He's the bore. Why are they pointing to that part of the room over there? Now, a bore is a fella who... You're not one. I know you. Now, a bore can either be male or female, but more often tends to be male. That is, it doesn't matter what conversation comes up. When you've talked with him for 2.5 minutes, you'd give anything to be somewhere else. Bore is the kind of fellow you'd never go fishing with, and certainly don't marry the fellow. Bores are bores, and they get worse after they get married. And a bore is somebody who, well, it'd be like you all know what a bore is. They always talk about little things. I was writing, I would not tell you the name of this person if you put me on the rack. But I took a trip recently with a bore. And this, we went down the road, and you know, most people just go down the road, you just ride down the road. This fella, he regularly had to say, "Oh, look at that barn. Isn't that at the barn? It's the barn there. Look at those cows." And he commented, you know, "There's a dog, you know." And after about 20 miles, I was ready to shoot a boar. Right? If I'd been packing a gun, they would have had one less boar in the world. You know, just absolutely nothing important, just noise. Prattle, prattle, prattle. And boars usually talk about themselves. They say to their wife, "Let me tell you about myself." And when he gets tired, he says, "Why don't you talk about me for a while?" The bore always tells you, after you've met him for 5 minutes, about 10 times more about himself than you ever wanted to know. Then comes the role player, the actor. He comes to the relationship with preconceived and unchangeable concepts of his role and hers. The role player works incessantly to make his role and to play his role and to make sure the wife plays hers. He goes into marriage with the idea he's not really himself, he's an actor. He's always on stage, always performing. And he's got this image, he's written this script in his mind about what kind of marriage they're going to have. And he spends the rest of his life playing the part and forcing his wife into the role of co-star. and he makes her follow his script. Any departure from the role by the wife is interpreted as betrayal. This young men often get into this. Young men, they will form images, and as do women, of what it's going to be like when they get married. But listen, what you think it's going to be like is not what it's going to be like. Let a marriage be what it is, guided by the principles we've talked about. But I know women who have been put through hell on earth by a husband who insisted that she be somebody she was not. Listen, fellas, who you marry is who she is. That's a person, and she is who she is. She is not necessarily what you would like her to be. And women, the same goes for you. Don't marry somebody and then make their life miserable because they don't fit into some preconceived image you brought to them. If you don't like, listen, if you don't like what they are, don't marry them. Do not marry what the person you expect them to be. Not that people do not grow and not that people do not change. And last of all comes a perfectionist. The last of the 10 least wanted men. He is characterized by unrealistic standards of behavior and achievement. He's the legalist, often an extreme legalist. He transfers his expectations to his marriage partner, and he has his set of rules. And everything has to be done exactly his way, exactly right, exactly on time, with every I dotted and every T crossed. And if it doesn't, then he brings his wrath down upon the home. He destroys the balance in the home by making impossible demands of himself, his wife, his children, and anyone who comes close enough to be included. But you got a legalist. A legalist finds it hard to keep a pet because the dogs always run away from home. The cats go out at night and don't come back, and the goldfish die. And the children of a legalist, the day they graduate from high school, they kiss the home goodbye and will never come back unless under pressure. They're gone. And this is, and the legalist, that the conservative Christian man is particularly in danger of being a legalist, because we have standards of morality. But hear me, while we have the standards, and you know what I teach about this, the home is a place of grace, not simply law. The legalist knows nothing of grace. The legalist, for instance, has his set punishments for infractions by his children, and they pay that penalty no matter what the circumstances. He never backs off. He never eases up. If he decides that they are going to do a certain thing, they do it. The legalist is the fellow that makes his three-year-old sit up in church for an hour and a half. It's cruel and unusual punishment. The legalist requires that his meals be on time. His wife be there when he wants her there. It's not a very happy situation. He thinks he's the head of the house when he's really not the head of a house. He's the warden of a prison. There's a difference between being an authoritarian. I'm an authoritarian. There's a difference between being an authoritarian and a perfectionist. Is this making sense to you? Oh, listen. You see, one of the hardest students, one of the hardest balance beams to walk is one of the hardest things to keep in balance, is to balance off setting high standards and being a perfectionist. It is one thing to have high standards. It is something else to be a perfectionist. The difference is that with the perfectionist, the tail wags the dog. Or put it this way, with the perfectionist, it's the Sabbath, it's man for the Sabbath. Remember Jesus taught this? It's the Sabbath for man. That's one of the sayings I use in our home a lot. It's the Sabbath is for man, not man for the Sabbath. The rules, the standards of the home are to build the home. The home does not exist for the sake of the rules. The rules exist for the sake of the home. And when you have to, and when the home starts to suffer, hear me, when the home starts to suffer, you change the rules. You say, if your rules are destructive. But the perfectionist cannot do that. The home can die, but his his rules live on forever. He's like, he's the fellow when he gets on a church board, memorizes the bylaws and always has a copy with him. He's the fellow who's always right and never bending, and usually spends his old age alone. Is this making sense to you? It's a very delicate thing to work with. Yes.
Do you find that most people just fall into one of these categories, or do a lot of people show just a little bit of each one?
I think every man, I'm talking about 10 least one men, every man is in danger of partaking of any combination of these. We have to be very careful. For instance, you understand what I'm saying? The perfectionist, for instance, let me give you an example of a perfectionist. My wife has taught me this. She's a very smart woman. We have the general rule at our house that the children take care of themselves. We don't wait on them hand and foot. And they're supposed to make their beds and pick up after themselves. Do they perfectly? None of them ever have. None of them ever have. But they do pretty well. And when you say, look, hey, the room before you leave, the room has to be cleaned up, so they go in and they clean it up. But my inclination would be to say, look, no matter what, it has to be done. But my wife pointed out, and of course, kids today are busy. You get a kid who's going to normal high school with all their homework requirements, and they're in extra activity, they're in track and chorus and whatever they're in, and they got friends. They live very busy lives. And the question is, and here's the question, at what point do you simply say, this room is going to be in perfect condition every morning, no matter what? Well, the question is, often with some kids is, how miserable are you willing to make them and yourself to accomplish that? And when do you say, look, we're going to generally enforce this standard, but it's not worth, you understand, it's not worth destroying the parent-child relationship over. In other words, do you say, and when do you give it the light touch? When you declare the room a disaster area and the public, warning the public health officials are going to close this down. We never let our kids be just filthy. But there are worse things than an unmade bed. Understand? Because what happens, what a perfectionist does, who's the legalist, the perfectionist is always dealing with the little things, and he's so obsessed with the little things, he never notices the big things. Understand? It's man for the Sabbath. And some of you may have been raised in a home like that. And it's a very miserable situation. Understand? It's a question of priorities.
How do you gauge the line between natural change and expectation?
That's a good question. I don't have a good answer. It just takes wisdom in each individual case. That is, if you're changing, in other words, how. When does the lack of change become unacceptable in children, say?
Well, like in choosing me, you sense the feeling that, you're going to see that person go through some changes, and then you look forward to those, as they develop and everything. But when is it, is there a line that you need to draw of expecting too much, or?
Yes. The basic, this is the kind of thing, Tim, if I understand what you're getting at, is you have to solve, it's one of these things you have to solve before the marriage. You see, now listen to me, I've taught you a number of times that you do not marry a project. You marry a person, men or women. It's not fair to marry somebody with the idea, I don't like what you are, but I think you got possibilities. you've got real, you know, I think there's really, I think I can make something out of you. I'm going to marry you, and I'm going to make something out of you. If that, do not do that. If you don't like what they are, don't marry them. Now, on the other side of that coin is, remember I said to the girls especially, you've got to see what a guy's going to be when he's young, when he's the Bible college age. You've got to see what they're going to be. But listen, you can tell what they're going to be. If a person has basic character, self-control, values, he has them. He'll mature in this. But if they don't have them now, they're not going to have them then. The basics have to be there, right? The basics have to be there. Now, so, and you cannot force it. They're not a project. Listen to me. Do not marry somebody who does not bring out the best in you. And you know this when you're going together. When you're with this person, are you at your best? Is it natural for you to be the best you? Or is it natural for you to be the worst you? And girls are especially vulnerable to this. Boys have more effect on girls in this particular area than girls do on boys. Boys, you understand what I'm saying? Girls do have effect on boys, but the weight is the other way. That's just the way things are. But it works both ways. And listen, we here at the Bible College, we professors, we veterans who see kids come and go year after year, we see this and it breaks our hearts sometimes. We'll see a girl or a guy who really are progressing and growing until they hook up with somebody. And then we see them go the other way. Or we see their growth stop. And we can see it. And we don't know what to do about it because you can only go so far. And so what I'm saying is, if you bring out the best in your mate, and your mate brings out the best in you, and that basic substance is there, you're not going to have to worry about it then. It'll be natural. But if that's not the case, then you've got a bad situation. Because you're always going to be wanting that person to be something that they really are never going to be. And that's a real situation. That happens in marriages. Some guys will bring any girl down they go with. And some girls will bring any guy down they go with. And you know exactly what I'm talking about. And when you identify people like that, just think of them as if they had AIDS. Stay away from them, they'll kill you. You understand what I'm saying? Do not marry that person. Let them stay single. Well, see what I'm saying? But if you marry somebody and bring out the best in you, then you don't have to worry about that. It'll happen. Any other questions or comments on this? Yes.
Can you tell the person that they're perfectionist or they ever see it?
That's a good question. You can't hardly tell them because they will, in their eyes, they're very righteous. Their goals are everything. It's very hard to deter a perfectionist like that. It's like this. Let me give you an example of a woman perfectionist. I'll give you an example. I like a house that is neat. Understand? That is, when I come home, when I get home today, I walk into a house where the beds are made. Or at least my wife's working this morning. If all the beds, our bed will be made. If the boys didn't get theirs made this morning, they'll be made by 2 o'clock. But usually they are. It'll be dusted. You don't have 4 days' dishes in the kitchen. There's order. Things are where they belong. Things are put away. I don't wade through a house. I like that. Some people, that doesn't matter to them. On the other hand, I've been in homes that were neat, and the people in the home served the home. That is, you could not live in a home. The children couldn't ever be comfortable because it was the Sabbath. It was man for the Sabbath. You understand? That is, you couldn't relax and be yourself. Why? Because you couldn't mess up the house. The house was more important than the people in it. It always looked great. You ever been in a house like that? Boy, it always looked great. Everything was just perfect. But let me tell you, houses that are perfect and they're going to be kept perfect no matter what tend to be empty houses as the years pass. Because people will go somewhere else, the kids and the grandkids, they'll go somewhere else where they can live. You see, I'm not talking about being a slob, but to live. And what do? Well, it's like, I know a guy once who his lawn, he loved his lawn. His lawn, and he fertilized, loved his lawn. He wouldn't let his kids play in their lawn. Why? Because they get out and play, and they get bare spots. So he'd run the kids off to play at the neighbor's house. Why? Because he wanted that lawn perfect, perfection. When I put our basketball goal up several years, we're on our second basketball backboard and rim at our house. When I put the first one up, same pole, put it up, beautiful grass there, and my wife just observed. She said, "You're going to have a big bare spot there. It's not. We play on the driveway, but you know when you shoot a layup, you veer off in the grass." And she was right. We got a big bare spot. But she didn't really. She wasn't objecting. And I said to her, and this is her philosophy as well as mine. We can always raise grass. Right now we're raising boys. When we get through raising boys, then we'll raise grass. No, I love that bare spot. To me, that's the prettiest part of the lawn. I don't have to cut it. But you know what that bare spot means to me? I think of all the hours I spent out there shooting basketball with my boy. Understand? I don't care about. I fertilize my lawn and I water it and I mow it or they mow it. You understand what I'm saying? The question is, what exists for what? And in the home, I've seen. We got a joke at our house. We first got married. My wife it was a new wife, and she bought some white rugs for our little attic apartment. I couldn't even walk in halfway. It was a gallery, really an attic made into an apartment. It had a slanting roof. I couldn't even walk in half of it because I was so tall. And she bought these white rugs, and not big rugs, smaller. And she said, and she didn't want me to step on the rugs, so she turned them over. And I really kidded her about. I tiptoed, I said, "Don't step on the rugs." And of course, she laughed, and I laughed, and we quit that nonsense, Why? Well, I said, "She hasn't bought a white rug since." Well, you can't walk on a white rug. Now, when I think of the perfections, I think of a white carpet. I was in a house one time, had a white carpet. If there's anything in this world that's stupid, it's a white carpet. Why? You cannot walk on a white carpet. What are carpets for? For walking on. A lot of people, their mind is like a white carpet. Their world is a white carpet. And what do? You walk around it, you admire it, but you don't walk on it. Are you getting the point? It's a question of, we're not against order, but there's a difference between order and perfectionism. Question, yes?
I'm going back to about the guys and the girls who are the worst people when you think. And as a parent, I see a lot of parents who lose their children, and all that is into their children, all that raised them, the child is, grows up to a good person, and marries somebody who brings them down, and it's like they've lost that child. And I'm just petrified, that's the one thing I'm petrified of, my children picking somebody and not seeing that person for who they are and losing them, really just losing your child to this person. And as a parent, I see a lot of parents who don't, they just sit there, and I don't know if I can do that. And how do you handle that when your child is dating somebody or going to marry somebody who makes them a worse person? How do you
that's an excellent question, and you ought to be scared. Because at the time, there's not much you can do. Because at the time, that your son or daughter is doing, is they cannot see it, and they will not see it. And it's not my, and if you press too hard, you will drive, you will, they'll marry them just to show you. And I know from experience, I'm speaking from experience now, that what you do is you suffer and you pray. And you worry and you pray. But afterwards, your child can see very clearly. They'll say, I can't believe I ever went with that person. They brought me down. You know, they can see it very clearly after what you saw all along, but they cannot see it at the time. So what you have to do is you have to teach them that their basic values and standards when they're young, so that they will draw the line and not before they go too far. They will eventually see it, and they do see it. But it's very hard.
What would you like
the
night before the wedding?
Listen, that's a good question, Laura, but there are no guarantees. And it will happen. There are no guarantees. Are no guarantees. Yes.
But if you brought up your life, you know, you spent your life bringing some children properly, everything, wouldn't they have a natural tendency to pick somebody?
Yes.
And, you know, you had that relationship with them. Because we, in our house, we are not told who we can and cannot date. You know, we already knew it. We were never given a curfew. We knew what coming home late was. You know. So, and I always knew if I went out with a guy that my parents didn't approve of, mom would be up washing dishes or knitting or doing something when I got home. And I didn't catch on at first. And then later on, if I dated somebody she liked, she'd be a fantastic. And I mean, it dawned on me, she never said a word, but it dawned on me that the guys that she liked were the ones that she trusted, she'd be asleep. So, you know, she never said a word, and she always knew who was the right.
Yes. And the key to this, one of the keys, Laurie, to this, is to have such a relationship with your children that your children genuinely care what you think, and they respect your view. They're not, in other words, that they're your friend, not your enemy. A lot of young people your age view their parents essentially as enemies, and they'll marry the person just as a weapon. And so you've got to make sure that you have developed the kind of relationship that they and also like you say, kids know whether you can't hide that. If you don't like somebody, they know it, and that's a pressure. You don't have to say anything. You can treat them with, you know, kindly and everything. But the kids, parents know. Our kids know. Don't you know? If you bring home somebody your mom and dad don't like, you know it. You know it.
Yeah.
But it's a real problem, and it really is, and it's a heartache. But really, I believe very much in prayer, providence. Be amazing. You can pray your way. You can pray your way through a lot of things. But it's a real concern. Let me say a word about the perfectionist, the legalist. Let me tell you about rules. Not necessarily for children, but for the home, is that, and we follow this policy here at the school, by the way. Our policy here at the school is to try to have as few rules as possible, but to enforce the ones we've got as best we can. We can't enforce rules perfectly, we know that. And many of the rules that we have, we were forced to. But we don't say, we don't try to look for trouble. Our policy has not been to look for trouble and make a rule for every imaginable circumstance. You could have a rule book that thick, but try to get by as few rules as possible and make rules only when they're necessary. Well, that's a good idea for the home, understand? As few rules as possible. First, like curfew. We'll come back to this later with parent-child. How strict do you enforce a curfew? Well, if you've got children who have common sense and who are basically on your side and who don't abuse it, you can be very free. You only have to get strict when you got a child who is not going to play the game. But you see, the perfectionist, he would draw an ironclad rule when his kid is 3 years old. When his kid is 3 years old, he's got this ironclad, unbreakable rule that you get to be in by 10:30. Well, we have a young lady in our church who's in college now, and she and her relationship with her parents really damaged, because even when she was a senior in high school, she had to be in at 10:30. Like, well, no matter what, no matter where they went. And if she stayed out past 10:30, she got grounded. This was 2 months before she graduated. You understand? She'd go out with the youth group, and she had a choice to make. The youth group wasn't going to get back to 11. Was she going to stay with the group and get in trouble and be grounded for 3 days next week, or all week? Or was she going to, and it's terrible. That's just not realistic. You understand? It's a legalist, perfectionist. Well, I think we pretty well exhausted. Any questions on this? Okay, we'll take our break and then we'll move on. Okay.